Chapter 18, The Galactic Clock Strikes the Hour. We've now seen geometry in the quantum realm, in biology, in the Earth, and in the solar system, as well as on the very large levels of superclusters and the background gas and dust at the farthest reaches of the universe. What about geometry within the galaxy itself? By simple logic, the geometric laws we see at work in the solar system should extend well beyond just one star and its planets. If the galaxy also has geometric force fields, we could potentially cross millions of years in an instant once we know how to access them. Many scientists estimate that the galaxy takes about 250 million years to complete one rotation. If life appeared on Earth roughly 3.5 billion years ago, as our microfossil records of bacteria suggest, then the entire history of life on Earth only appeared during the last 14 galactic rotations. That makes it seem much faster than we usually would think. The Earth itself didn't exist prior to 4.54 billion years ago, which is just over 18 rotations into the past. Even the origin of the universe, estimated at no more than 13.9 billion years ago, is only about 55 rotations away. If all life on Earth is only 14 galactic years old, it becomes much easier to imagine how all these rotations could blend together in time-space, forming one giant repeating cycle. Each time you're at the same place in the galaxy you were at before, the same energetic conditions might again prevail. Let's think back for a minute to the evolution cycle discovered by Mueller and Rode. Every 62 million years, we see massive bursts of evolution appear on Earth, and this is directly correlated with an up-and-down motion of our solar system through the galaxy, which is believed to take 64 million years to complete. Richard C. Hoagland was the first to point out to me, in private conversation, that if you set the rotation of the galaxy at roughly 250 million years, you find exactly four of these 62 million-year cycles in one galactic rotation. Four equidistant points in a circle form a square, so we may very well be looking at an octahedron in the galaxy, or a cube, that is actually driving evolution on Earth. This was a stunning development. Our solar system's up-and-down movement through the galactic plane could be the direct result of the gravitational flow around each corner of the geometry. Since Hans Jenny showed there is a constant flowing movement in, around, and through these geometric vortexes when they appear in a fluid. So as we head toward one corner, we're on an upswing, and then when we pass that corner, we shift into another current and get pulled into a downswing. What about other geometry in the galaxy? Remember that Sanderson's icosahedron on Earth created 10 vortex points that were near the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn, all evenly spaced apart. If you divide the galaxy's 250 million-year orbit into 10 equal parts, you have 25 million years each, which is reasonably close to the 26-million-year cycle Raup and Sepkoski originally discovered. In fact, if the level of solar radiation increased in a measurable way, once this new sphere of geometry kicked in, that could increase the amount of radiation being stored in the fossil record, and thus make it look more like 26 million years had gone by each time, when it was really closer to 25 million. Soon afterward, I realized that the double tetrahedron has six equidistant points along the equator, just like the Star of David in two dimensions. But there are six more equidistant points in the interior. This means you get a total of 12 equidistant points along the equator, within one sphere of energy. This now potentially explained the basis of the moon's 12 orbital cycles for every Earth year, as well as the deeper meaning of the 12 signs and houses in the zodiac. Furthermore, the 12 ages of the zodiac could represent a larger double tetrahedron geometry that takes us 25,920 years to move through. We may now have a geometric basis for why the number 12 appears so repeatedly in these cycles. We know that based on the behavior of these unseen energy fields, both the galactic octahedron and the galactic icosahedron should also have spheres of energy that surround them and travel along with them. And we also know that a more complex geometry would be vibrating at a higher frequency, just like Liu and Spilhaus observed in the growth of the Earth. Therefore, it would appear that during the 62-million-year cycle, a lower-frequency sphere of galactic energy was moving through the solar system. This sphere would have the geometry of an octahedron or cube in time. Each sphere appears to be rippling away from the center of the galaxy at a slow, even speed. Once the galactic octahedron passed us by, we came under the influence of the galactic icosahedron, though the shadows of the octahedron still are tugging on us a bit, as Mueller and Rode discovered. A higher frequency sphere of energy then flooded into our solar system, and this may have created enough of an increase in solar radiation that it made the fossil record appear to have a 26-million-year cycle rather than a 25-million-year pattern. Carbon dating is based on a smooth, unchanging flow of solar radiation in order to produce the results we see. The new 25-million-year cycle started appearing in the fossil record some 250 million years ago, meaning we've now had 10 cycles, or one complete revolution of the galaxy, since it started. Since we've now completed a full circle, that may very well mean that we're now moving into the next big bubble of energy, with an even higher level of coherence. Also, let's not forget that the original solid crust of the Earth began breaking up along equidistant points that formed a tetrahedron by about 220 million years ago, perhaps showing the gradual, long-term Earth effects that kicked in once this new sphere of energy arrived. The grid may very well be shifting into a new configuration at this time, which could explain why honeybees and other migratory animals are getting increasingly lost and confused. Galactic energy spheres outside the Milky Way. If this is truly a universal harmonic system we're dealing with, then these expanding spheres should be detectable in other galaxies. We remember that the source field often flows into our spacetime through non-visible electromagnetic frequencies, such as ultraviolet. So, we could look for changes in the electromagnetic spectrum of galaxies, in rippling, circular, concentric layers like an onion. And that is exactly what we find. This amazing story was covered in an April 1993 issue of Discover magazine. Dr. William Tift was studying redshift, which is electromagnetic radiation from space, outside the visible spectrum in the microwave range. Normally, astronomers assume these frequencies indicate how far away something is. Tift's discoveries seriously challenged that preciously guarded model, because he found that redshift did not stay the same in one galaxy. It was separated into concentric layers. The frequency grew increasingly higher as you moved toward the center, and it always changed by the same amount. Again, he used the word quantized to describe these separate layers. The Discover article compared this galactic phenomenon to the energy states of an atom. And let's not forget that Kozarev also discovered a quantized change in the weight of an object after he bumped some of its atoms over into time-space. The atoms seemed to be popping back in through layers of geometry that would reappear one at a time over 15 to 20 minutes. Best of all, Tift found that these spheres of energy were on the move, just as we would expect, based on the fossil record. More recently, Tift has also claimed to have evidence from observing the same galaxies over a period of 10 years that their redshifts change over time. We may be seeing some form of galactic evolution taking place before our very eyes, he says. Despite the fact that this is considered rogue astronomy because it slaughters the sacred cow of redshift, a variety of credible investigations have concluded that the quantized redshift effect is genuine. One 2006 study detected one of Tift's redshift values at a 95% confidence level. A 2007 study reviewed the history of all these investigations from the 1970s up until the time they published and concluded that the effect really could be genuine. In 2003, Bell and Camot found the same quantized layers of energy, like concentric spheres within an onion, in fully 91 different galaxies. A different study from the Journal of Astrophysics and Astronomy in 1997 examined over 250 different galaxies and found these same layers of energy in every single one of them. The effect was so obvious that it could be easily seen by eye in maps of the frequencies, and they said the confidence levels were extremely high. Independent proof from Dr. Harold Aspden. Dr. Harold Aspden has created an incredible encyclopedic body of work on his energy science website. Since the 1960s, he explored the idea that all matter is created from an ether, and he concluded that it has different levels of density or thickness. These discoveries were generated by a reshuffling of the Maxwell equations, which are still used in calculations to design and construct electrical equipment. Maxwell's equations automatically assume there is an ether, and because it works, no one questions it. Aspden was the first to find out that he could rearrange these equations, all in logical ways, and conclude that this ether had to have different levels of density. These equations also revealed what the exact electromagnetic frequencies would be when these layers of ether flowed into our own reality. Aspden was utterly shocked to discover that the numbers he had generated theoretically in these equations were identical to the actual frequencies Tift had measured in his spherical concentric layers, or space domains, which have been seen in over 250 different galaxies. The conclusion one reaches from this remarkable result is that galaxies can, so far as the different space domain origins of their primary radiation sources are concerned, lock into slightly different sets of fundamental physical constants. The author recognized the need to accept the existence of such space domains, even within our local galactic system, in Chapter 16 of his 1972 book. Such domains have bearing on geological events, such as geomagnetic field reversals occurring as the solar system transits through boundaries separating adjacent space domains. This is direct confirmation of what I expected, namely that we can prove there are layers of energy in the galaxy that can completely transform the Earth and solar system as they sweep through, causing measurable changes. Geomagnetic pole reversals are not what we're looking for. It's the effects on life that seem to be jumping out at us, since many evolutionary events did not involve any cataclysmic activity. Tau space. Tift himself also theorized about what was creating these strange effects. And given everything we've been discussing, the results are astonishing. Tift has obviously never read Dewey Larson's Physics, but but he came up with the exact same thing to explain what he was seeing. In summary, we have examined a model based upon two coexisting 3D spaces, one of time, one of space. I was thrilled when I realized Tift had independently discovered this on his own. Let's read a little more. Quantum physics resides in tau space, and conventional dynamics operates in sigma space. Although there as yet exists no formal mathematical framework linking these spaces, at least none Tift was aware of at the time, there is a wealth of empirical consistency with observations. This includes properties ranging from the masses and forces at the fundamental particle level, through redshift quantization, to cosmological effects on the largest scale. Time as a three-dimensional quantity appears to be a promising subject for investigation. The word tau means time. So Tift is almost using the exact same language as the term time-space, only with the Greek letter for time instead. In this same paper, he says, at a given cosmic radius in tau space, a galaxy occupies a specific temporal state. It must change that temporal state in discrete steps. I was amazed at how well all of this fit together. The model is extremely elegant. When we combine Tift and Aspdin's conclusions, we know that at least at some point, we could enter into a new space domain of tau space, where matter and energy as we know it locks into a slightly different set of fundamental physical constants and changes its temporal state in a discrete step. Neither of these great scientists seem to be aware of how well their model extends to explain the 26 and 62 million year cycles that were found in the fossil record, showing that these changes in the flow of time also affect biological life, as well as the fundamental physical constants of matter and energy. Changes in the solar system. We've almost got a perfect model at this point. The last thing we need to find out is whether our solar system is already going through a change in its temporal state, where we indeed enter into a new space domain that will lock in a slightly different set of fundamental physical constants. In simple terms, if we're at the boundary of one of these domains right now, complete with all the coherence-increasing, DNA-evolving properties that come along with it, we should expect to see measurable changes in the sun and planets. This would provide smoking gun proof that the ancient prophecies were indeed correct. As Dmitriev already suggested, these changes would be the direct result of an increasing flow of time through the solar system, or, as he put it, an increase in the number of vacuum domains, or vortexes into time-space, coming in. And, lo and behold, once we begin seeking evidence for interplanetary climate change, we find many solid data points from reputable NASA and ESA scientists. The Sun. Since at least the late 1970s, the Sun's overall radiation emissions have increased by 0.5% per decade. Between 1901 and 2000, the Sun's magnetic field increased in size and strength by 230%. As of 1999, high increases in the amount of helium and heavier charged particles coming out of the Sun were observed. One NASA scientist said in 2003 that the Sun was more active than in living memory. A mainstream geophysical team recently proved that the Sun has been more active since the 1940s than in the previous 1,150 years combined. The new brightening all started in the last 150 years. As of November 2004, this same group proved that the sun is more energetic than it has been in at least 8,000 years. Then, in 2006, NASA announced that the sun's Great Conveyor Belt, a massive circulating current of hot plasma, had slowed down from a normal walking speed of 1.0 meters per second to 0.75 meters per second in the north, and only 0.25 meters per second in the south. Prior to recent times, the speed had stayed consistent since the 19th century, and it took about 40 years, two cotons, to complete a circuit. This may be a sign that the flow of time within the sun is changing, as we discussed earlier. In 2008, NASA said this was a substantial, historic, and important change. The sun's surface flows have slowed dramatically. In 2009, NASA reported that this is the quietest sun we've seen in almost a century due to the surprising lack of sunspots and flares on the surface. BBC News admitted that astronomers were baffled by this, particularly because, as Dr. Mike Lockwood explained, the sun's overall activity peaked in about 1985 and has been on a noticeable downtrend since then, even as overall global temperatures have risen. If the sun's dimming were to have a cooling effect, we'd have seen it by now. At the same time, scientists also fear there might be a massive new peak of solar activity that could potentially fry electronics on Earth, and gave a surprisingly familiar-sounding target date of September 2012 for when this may happen. A Live Science article in 2007 seriously considered the social anthropologist Dr. Benny Pizer's suggestion that the sun could be responsible for measurable global warming on Mars, Jupiter, Neptune's moon Triton, and Pluto, as well as the Earth. Surprisingly, this is one of very few mainstream media articles to have ever made this obvious connection. But the data in Pizer's analysis is only a small part of the story. Mercury. Despite supposedly high surface temperatures, Mercury seems to have ice in its polar regions. It also has an unexpectedly dense core and strong magnetic field. Scientists would like to know how these anomalies are possible. In 2008, Mercury was found to have several signatures indicating significant pressure within the magnetosphere that it didn't have in the 1970s. By 2009, it had gotten much more intense. The Messenger probe was now seeing magnetic twisters, and the scientists were surprised at how strongly it changed. These tornadoes were 10 times as strong as any ever seen on Earth. Venus. The amount of sulfur in Venus's atmosphere decreased dramatically between 1978 and 1983. Venus's overall nightside brightness increased by a whopping 2,500% between 1975 and 2001. Scientists cannot explain this sudden change in brightness, though it suggests that the oxygen content of Venus's atmosphere may have substantially increased. A tail of charged plasma trailing behind Venus was measured to be 60,000% longer in 1997 than in the late 1970s. Both the northern and southern hemispheres of Venus dramatically brightened in January 2007, and a strange, unusual, and mysterious bright spot appeared in July 2009. Regarding this sudden new bright spot, Dr. Sanjay Lamaya said, "It's fair to say something unusual happened on Venus. Unfortunately, we don't know what happened."